afternoon, and welcome to another edition of Punkonomics, your weekly discussion show, broadcasting live from WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. My name is Jesse Velez, and Dr. Benjamin Balick, our host, is here today.
He
looks all tired from trying to find parking here on campus.
No, it wasn't too bad, actually.
It wasn't that bad.
No, the parking's okay.
That's one of my favorite people here and one of the usual suspects, and that's Corey Carroll.
Hey, guys.
All right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you need to be here more often.
You know, when you guys changed the show to Saturday from 1 to 3, I was like, all right, I'm going to be there a lot. And then it just for a couple months it has
worked. Yeah, no, it is, right. It's difficult sometimes to go back to work on Saturday a little. It feels a little bit like that, you know?
I know, but, you know, what can I say? For me, it works out a lot better.
Yeah.
Although, having done my night show, it's kind of hard to wake up and do this one.
Right, before.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, it's one.
I don't come out until the sun goes down. So right. The sun kind of burns my skin. Anyway, before we got on the show, we were talking about the gentrification and what...
We should say welcome parents. I think they have live music out. Yeah, it's parents weekend.
Right.
It's a little freaky, it's all good.
A good way to segue to San Francisco in a little bit would be, you guys were talking about something with parking in downtown Orlando.
Right.
Right. I mean, you fill me in on that because I actually don't know what's going on.
Well, I do, again, as usual, I don't know the specifics. I mean, I'm actually more familiar with the general patterns, right? So I think that the city of Orlando has been doing some of this. I don't know to what extent. I think pretty much all cities are doing it, maybe with some exceptions. The idea being that especially parking is an example. Many cities are selling off their parking spots to private companies, and the concern being that this is really a public space paid by our tax money that is then... The deals that are cut are not in the interest of the taxpayers. It's not like the city hall is outsourcing effectively running the parking meters or anything like that. And it's one of those big myths that we are told that if it's private, it's efficient. If it's public, it is inefficient. And frankly, while indeed, it must be said that public is often inefficient, private is just as inefficient if structured badly.
Well, being from Chicago, I have a little bit of experience with this. With privatization of parking. And actually, just in general, the privatization of public assets, right? The city of Chicago, for a very long time, has been selling these revenue-producing assets, right? They had a toll road, I guess. I'm not sure if that was actually Chicago or the state of Illinois. I can finally hear myself.
Yeah,
that
microphone is messed up.
Oh, do you want me to switch over?
Yeah, I got you.
All right, here, I'm coming over.
There we go.
So anyways, City of Chicago, they have, over the years, they've not sold off. What they do is they do these long-term leases, like 100-year leases on revenue-producing assets. And the reason they do that is to free up money in the short term, right?
Right.
So most recently in the financial crisis, I mentioned this to you guys outside, 2009, the world is coming to an end seemingly. And City of Chicago, they signed a 100-year lease with a private company for all the parking spots and parking meters in the City of Chicago for $1 billion. A billion sounds like a lot, and on a short-term cash infusion basis, that was a lot.
Takes care of the immediate deficit.
Exactly. Now the city is missing that revenue for the next 100 years. Right?
Okay.
And that was a great source of revenue for the city. That was... You know, the theory goes a long time ago, right? The public invested in streets and roads. The parking spots were part of that investment, right? And the fees that the public paid when they would parking in those spots, that was, you know, sort of a dividend you got over time. It repaid the investment and it went back into the public coffers. And I mean, frankly, I see that arrangement as efficient, right? I mean, if we're going to talk about efficiency, I mean, how inefficiently can you administer a parking meter, right? But I guess, you know, cities, they're strapped for cash in the short term. So they kind of make these, I would say they're financially dubious, decisions.
For which
in some cases, they could be very corrupt
Right. Decisions, like in the case of the city of Chicago, there was some involvement with the consortium, the private consortium that leased those parking spots. They had a relationship to Mayor Daley. There's a long history of
Corey
stuff like that.
Corey is struggling trying to keep polite. Oh, sorry, I'm yelling, I know. It's just wonderful to see him like literally riffing around a little bit and struggling, trying to remain polite and positive.
I always try to hold some sort of a middle ground.
Describe the complete racket, you know. Might be some corruption. No kidding.
But you know, that's one of the consequences of legacies, because the Daley's been there for what? Forever.
That's right, yeah. His father, and this is funny, my grandfather had a newspaper clipping that he kept, used to be in his kitchen, and it was from like the 70s, and it was from Daley Sr., right? Mayor Daley Sr., there is a thing on the front page of, I want to say, either the Washington Post, maybe it was the Chicago Sun-Times, probably on a couple papers. There was a bit of a scandal in the 70s that Mayor Daley Sr. gave his son all of the insurance business.
Oh, I remember
Chicago,
that.
Right? So, I mean, that's a lot.
Okay, the conflict.
Chicago's a big city. If it were an economy, I want to say a standalone economy would be like in the top 30 in the world. Mm. I mean, it's bigger than some countries. So, and it has a lot of public employees. So, I mean, you know, you're dealing with health insurance, liability insurance, you know, property insurance.
I'm guessing non-competitive contract.
Often they are
competitive, they're not really competitive.
It was so long ago, I don't know what the actual terms were, but I mean, he basically just gave it to his son, and the headline read, if you can't help your son, who?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny because it's been decades since George Carlin exposed the, you know, nasty 7 or 8 words that you can't say on the air or on TV.
But why does Bono get to say the F word then?
Oh, because it's, you know. Because
it's Bono.
Daley Sr. might have said then it was, you can go to hell. Okay, I mean, it was something like, I mean, that's like the front page of the newspaper.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's legacies for you, you know. The Clintons, the Bushes, I mean.
Well, it's part of it, right? No, it's true, though. The issue of the legacy is part of it. It's stratification, monopolies, the concentration of power, all of these things that have come to be that are incompatible with our so-called capitalistic economic system.
I mean, really, I mean, can anybody even think of a benefit to having some sort of a legacy? I mean, what's the positive that arises from having, you know, multiple generations of politicians, if you will?
Well, if you're in a legacy, if you're invited, if you're insider, then you...
Oh, yeah, if you're an insider, it's great. But, like, I mean, could you even make some sort of a rational outside argument for it?
But you know, that then again, you know, and this is going to be my segue into San Francisco because I'm burning to say
something.
Then again, sometimes, you know, a city like San Francisco, which has always been kind of very progressive and, you know, voting in different people, not keeping the whole legacy factor. And the last 25 years, what they've had is a disaster for mayors. And the reason I'm, you know, trying to bring it in for those of you who are listening and maybe have never been to San Francisco or have been, but have been there lately. The gentrification, and it's actually the conversation we were having before we got into the studio, is horrendous. I mean, I've never seen anything like that. I mean, I would complain once in a while when they were doing that in Manhattan, New York, under the Giuliani reign. But at the same time, you know, my relatives were the ones living there and the ones, you know, going through that whole thing. So I never paid too much attention. And I guess what I'm getting at is the American public should pay attention to San Francisco right now, because that is basically the picture of what's going to happen to all our major cities, the gentrification via corporate greed. And going into corporate greed, I mean, you might think that Apple and some of these big tech companies are the ones doing all the damage to the city. Well, I have mixed feelings about that. I'm a tech person myself, and, you know, most of us here are. But you have to look at where it's coming from. You have City Hall, okay, which is in San Francisco right now, is just useless, selling the city to these major construction developers. And what's going on is, most people don't know the politics of the city when it comes to real estate, but they have this thing called the Ellis Act. Okay, now, people like myself, a transplant. I mean, I lived there for about 20-some years, you know, you go in, you rent a place, and if the owners of the building decide to, you know, capitalize on the movement of the real estate market, they can easily give you a notice that says, okay, we're going to move into your apartment, so you have 1 year to leave, and we'll give you X amount of money, which is usually like chump change. And what's been happening is that a lot of the owners of these buildings, they have been cutting deals between City Hall and these development companies and getting, you know, from thousands to, you know, millions of dollars to vacate so these developers can come into the city or into that particular area and completely demolish and put up these cookie cutters for apartments, like you were saying, under the premise of work, live for artists. Now, back in 2000...
Just 1 second, just to be clear, because I'm actually not totally aware of this. To be clear, is City Hall, is the city of San Francisco, fronting the money to help help landlords and developers people to vacate?
In a sense, because what they do is, let's say Google, for instance, okay, for the longest time they were shuttling people from Silicon Valley, you know, to the city. And what they found was that it was probably more productive to actually start doing business within the city. So what they did was they went in, probably talked to, I'm thinking about the years, and they probably just talked to Mayor Yi, who is the current mayor there, and went like, okay, we want to bring more revenue to the city, but what can you do for us? And what they do is they say, well, okay, fine, you don't have to pay taxes for X amount of years. We'll give you all these incentives, okay, and basically that's it. And of course, you can't really blame the techie for moving into San Francisco. Beautiful city. It's happening the whole bit. But what happens is that because there's so many, I mean, if you think of a company that has 20,000 people, all of a sudden moving into the city, boom, you're right away giving up.
There's a mismatch between supply and demand.
Right, exactly. So what's been happening is that people, and I've seen it, when I was there, I started to see it, my landlord, gritty as hell. He was already cutting these beautiful Victorians, you know, and making them into like rooms and charging like $400 for one room. And all you have is basically a bed, you know, and a, common bathroom, you know, for everybody that was living in the city. So what's happened now is that they've gone even further. There's this, company called, Airbnb.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And
very controversial, by the way.
Oh, and what they're doing is a prime example. And I saw a documentary the other night, and I was telling Dr. Balick and Corey that I got so depressed. I opened up a bottle of wine and drank the whole thing because I couldn't stand it anymore. But what Airbnb has done.
Are you concerned your friend drinks too much?
Yeah, my bartender drinks too much.
Play that one.
But what Airbnb is actually doing, because they just got the go-ahead, is that they're coming in, they're not paying any taxes, city taxes,
they
to
don't
operate.
They don't pay hotel taxes either, which
right.
is...
No regulations.
Yep.
No regulations at all. So you have all these mom-and-pop hotels, like in the beach areas of San Francisco. I mean, we were talking about, like, small little mom-and-pops have been there for, you know, 50, 60, 70
rules,
years.
Right?
Playing by the rules, barely making it. Because they're keeping their prices, you know, competitive. So here comes Airbnb, and they go like, okay, you can stay at this place for X amount of money, which is, wait.
Oh, we just lost.
We just lost something here.
Did we lose?
Okay. Yo, yo, yo. Well,
okay.
We
still lost it.
Well, we're still broadcasting.
Oh, it might be your monitor.
Okay, so we just can't hear it in the headphones.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Basement radio. There we go.
I'm seeing it on the audio board.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Anyway, folks, a little tech stuff here. Bottom line is that what they've done is they've come in, no regulations, getting all these incentives and
yeah, like
kickbacks, and they're totally stealing away the business of the small people. That's just one example. What you're also having is that these major construction companies, they're coming in and they're demolishing, you know, old buildings that used to be there and making them into what I said earlier, the work, live, artist thing. And under that, which actually happened during Willie Brown, they come in on the printer. CEOs are making $400,000-$500,000. They come in under the premises that they're artists, right? And that they're going to use that location to do their art. Well, no, they're not. They're just actually either living in there or conducting the business right off of it. And what they've been doing is they're pushing the local artists, I mean, the street people that San Francisco is famous for, they're pushing straight out of the city. What we've been seeing, and I've been in touch with a lot of my friends, what we've been seeing is that now the local San Franciscan has no place to go. If you're middle class, okay, and if you're not making more than $150,000 a year, you're out. And people are migrating to the Richmond district, which really a lot of us never even thought about even moving out there, because you know you got a lot of crime and all that kind of stuff. But even more so, historic Candlestick Park. I mean, the place where the Beatles played their last concert in the U.S. Is being demolished to put all these high rises. So they're transforming the skyline of San Francisco to a point to where the concept of concrete jungle, which applies to Manhattan, New York, is right now in San Francisco. And the whole genre of us at San Francisco saying, oh, tourists, come and leave your money and say goodbye, that's not happening anymore, because the only people that are able pretty soon in the future to come and see San Francisco is just going to be rich people.
Well, now, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. The building that's, am I good?
Go ahead. Okay. Yeah.
The building that's going on, I mean, to a large extent, isn't that just a natural response to supply and demand? I mean, obviously, demand is higher.
Right.
You have this influx of jobs, and they're not just normal jobs, they're rather high-paying jobs. So, I mean, doesn't there need to be some sort of a natural response in, you know, within the city?
Sure. The problem is with that, you know, I think everybody's in favor of progress, you know, and making things better. The problem with that is that when you have two classes, the homeless and the rich, in a city that's basically, you know, supposed to be a melting pot and an example for the world, what happens is if you have a natural disaster like the last earthquake, which I was there and seeing what happened to that city, all of a sudden you only have, let's say, Golden Gate Bridge goes down.
Yeah.
Okay. You only have one entrance because let's face it, the Bay Bridge will go down too. So you only have one entrance. What happens is that, and we saw it, all these companies, they're infusing all this money into the city. They left. And that's exactly what's going to happen. And in a major earthquake, and they're forecast to have a major one sometime in the near future, they've been saying it.
It's an eventuality. I mean, you're on a tectonic plate.
Right.
I mean,
what's going to happen is that the city will go down in an economic demise that we've never seen in a long time. And we're talking about it's going to be at least 8 to 10 years before it even comes back to the economy they had, let's say, in the 1990s, you know, which was still kind of affordable for the middle class. And everybody had the little chance to live in San Francisco, work there, and enjoy the good life. I mean,
those were the days, you know. I mean, essentially, you're talking about a specific case of San Francisco, but in different ways, it's happening all over the place, even here in Winter Park.
Right, right.
New York's already done, pretty much. All the boroughs are pretty much impossible to live in or get in there. And it's also, you know, a local, right, a metropolis version of what's going on nationally and beyond, you know, and internationally.
Right.
It's true. This is a major problem because it's unsustainable.
Right. And the thing is, I mean, if you get past that, let's say, okay, fine, you know, everybody has the right to go and live and work and do whatever they want. But what happens is that in a major catastrophe, then the city has to put up that money to be able to get things going again, because you no longer have that income from all these major companies. Versus before, when they were scattered all through Silicon Valley, Palo Alto, and wherever, you know, you were still getting money to the state.
Well,
you
then
know?
You will get even big, sweeter deals. So these companies do no longer contribute. There's a reason why the cities are broke in many senses. Maybe even that's one of the reasons why they are forced to be playgrounds for the wealthy. That's the only source of revenue.
Right.
Maybe at the genesis of the United States, right? part of the idea of having the individual states with some autonomy was that there would be regulatory competition. And at the idea at the time, it seemed like a good idea, right? Because the idea, our founding fathers, they didn't see it as necessarily a race to the bottom, which is what it's become.
Right.
The idea was that there would be a qualitative race for, you know, better governance. That was the idea. It was this idea of, you know, evolution acting upon governance. That didn't work out, right? Basically, what we have is we have this dynamic where it's just a constant race to the bottom. Which city can give the biggest company the biggest tax break in order to...
And then the company leaves or renegotiates and threatens to leave if the conditions aren't met, like Boeing, I think, recently in Seattle.
Every city, they need the jobs, right? You need you need jobs in order to survive as a city. So, I mean, what do you do?
Right.
The easy thing, if you're a newly elected mayor or, you know, in the case of a state, a governor, is like, okay, we need to go after some of these big companies because, I mean, it just seems completely unfathomable to go after a million small guys.
Right. But the laws are completely unfair because if you think about it, even if they, let's say we're going to pay 50% of the taxes they should be paying anyway, they'll still get out of it through some kind of loophole or...
Well, the thing that really gets to me, and this is something that you probably have to address at like a federal level, is this race to the bottom only benefits the largest companies, right? The small guy who opens up a restaurant or, you know, a dry cleaner or like a hardware store, if people even do that anymore, I'm just hypothetical.
Right.
He's not going to get a tax break from the city or the state. But, you know, if Google shows up, no property taxes, right? You know,
and that's just it. I mean, you're looking at businesses right now.
Not to Google, I mean, just...
Businesses right now... you know, let's say, I found this outrageous and I personally thought that people were just kind of joking about this, in conversations, but you know, $56 for a burger. That's what's happening in the restaurants now over there. I mean, who can afford to pay that except for
those who live there?
Right. Know, when you, before we came on, I mentioned there's a thing, it's kind of going viral on the internet right now. There's a listing on Craigslist in San Francisco for a one bedroom. Right? In an apartment. That's what it's like listed as, one bedroom. But what it is it's a closet under a staircase with a twin mattress wedged into it. And it's like $2,250 or $2,500 a month.
Right.
For that.
Now compare this. Okay. Now you basically hit it right on the nail. You know, and earlier we were talking about exactly that. My apartment in San Francisco, and I lived in, close by, Haight-Ashbury, or what people, you know, recognize as the Summer of Love and, you know, Grateful Dead hanging out and that kind of stuff back in the 60s. I mean, when I lived there, it was kind of like a shabby environment, you know, I mean, a lot of local artists and stuff like that, very cool neighborhood, but I had a one bedroom with a car garage and I paid $950 when I left San Francisco in 2005. Right now, last time, one of my former neighbors and really good friend, John Carr, was saying that my apartment right now goes anywhere between $5,000 and $7,000 for a one bedroom. I mean, that's
so you kind of have to
unbelievable.
You have to kind of have to scratch your head and ask where the breakdown is, because if under like a classical economics model, right, the market's supposed to respond to price, and you know companies are included in that in that market. So I mean, you know, if a company doesn't want to pay his employees as much, right, wouldn't it make sense for them to go to somewhere where the cost of living is lower? But I mean, that seems like a sensible approach. That's easy.
No, there are real urban. Yeah. I know urban network effects are important
exactly,
today.
Because yeah. Then you have the dynamic of, in the case of tech companies in San Francisco, okay, well, what if we lose a key engineer? You know, if we're in the middle of nowhere, Kansas, we're not going to be able to hire that engineer, right? Mm. But if we're in San Francisco, maybe, you know, one of them left Apple or, you know, a startup or something, or Stanford. You know?
Right, but I mean, it just boils down to this. It's just downright corporate greed. And
but that's okay. The corporations are made to be greedy. That's the thing. I mean, it's rule of law. It's more accountability. I mean,
survival of the fittest, sure.
Power is concentrated tremendously. Okay, let's go all the way. I mean, it's of economic thought. I mean, this whole, what you're describing here, guess who predicted it pretty and much in detail, precisely the concentration of power and how the financial instability, I mean, really remarkable. Karl Marx.
It's scary.
Yes, that Karl Marx, right?
Crystal ball.
And of course, over much of the time since Karl Marx, and certainly in the 20th century, you had a lot of people who were criticizing it, right? right? But again, not like we hear today, you know, with just spitting out obscenities, but really engaging with him seriously. And I like to remind everybody every time, I'm sorry if you've heard it before, that the whole kind of conservative type of economics, right-wing economics, Milton Friedman, Hayek, a very popular guy, one of the most popular, von Mises, his teacher, the Austrian economist, all this body, and there are others, this part of the body of the right-wing economic thinking, was basically engaging with Marx and coming up with innovative ideas of why his dire predictions are not going to happen if we're careful. If we're careful. They took him very seriously, by the way. And, you know, okay, he deserves the credit for being so, to seeing these problems very early on, but we deserve the discredit, certainly as a professional economist, to have not seen the problem, seem to still struggle with these problems, as if it's so complicated to realize what happens eventually when there's no competition.
Right.
And it can't work like that. So we really have a situation in which we have created an environment in which a market-based capitalist economy cannot survive because it's reminiscent of what was the year before. Precisely how long will these cities function on these jobs that are indeed volatile and can move out quickly if that becomes better for them? Why, you know, that's they're responsible for their shareholders, not sure. For the... It's the city hall that's responsible for the citizens.
Right.
And if we can hold them accountable so that if they sell our public goods to private interests at a discount, they don't get reelected, or there's somebody else that can be elected in their place that's different.
Well, it's gotten so bad in the city right now that they're starting to question the mayor on, you know, bribery and stuff like that. And I guess the FBI, for what I'm told, is starting to look into Mayor Yee's little... transactions with all these companies.
You know, to a large extent, though, I mean, I gotta say, this is a two-way street because, I mean, I have to say the voters are also responsible. I mean,
absolutely.
There's a great example just
locally
recently.
They are. Right.
There's a great example recently. I want to say it's in Alabama. In the Democratic primary in Alabama for governor, you know, they're trying to see who's going to be on the ballot. A truck driver with a very generic name. I almost want to say it's like John Smith. It might be like.
Oh yes, I saw that.
He won the Democratic nomination to be the governor to run for the governor of Alabama. He filled out paid like $55, filled out something, you know, with the state of Alabama piece of paper. He forgot he did it. He was on the ballot. His mom called him. He's like, and she said, "Are you running for governor?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, I forgot." He got the nomination.
No, that's just, right.
People basically, right. And the political scientists that, I mean, this has actually caused a bit of a ruckus among them. Basically, what they're saying is, well, he had a very normal sounding name, and he was the first name on the ballot, and that's why.
I'm surprised. Yeah. I mean, you know, people don't vote. In the more local, the less people vote, right?
It's, yeah. Remarkable.
Well, in fact, if anything, it should be the other way around. The rational thing is not to vote for president, but to vote for town hall or whatever local,
right.
Because there you do have much more influence and potentially maybe the power could bubble up. At the top levels, it's tight. It's totally secure. There's no real, though even there, I mean, I want to, listen, here it's, I just passed my immigration exam and all that, my interview, so now I'm just a ceremony away from being a fully fledged American.
I wish I could see your face, Ronnie.
Yeah, I know, it'll be fine. Yeah, I know, I'm prone.
Just raise your hand and go, say hi!
Yeah, I'm prone to, as I've had to tell students over the past week, I'm prone to excessive patriotism and yelling, the Constitution at people these days. So you'll have, my apologies there a little bit. But seriously though, well, you know, it's a ceremony.
I can see you, you know, in the same room with President Obama, and you're going like, "Oh, my Führer, what are you doing to this country?"
No, but, you know, well, not much. I mean, the usual. Let's say that's what he's doing. But it is true that I'm very. So I'm looking for positive things, and I'm encouraged in many ways that the American people's response. I know, again, it's another thing I keep saying, but, you know, whatever. So yeah, you know, Americans have lost faith in the social contract.
Americans. The Economist back in like 2010, mm-hmm. something like that. It was on the cover, and it was
everywhere.
It was more or less. It said, everyone in the world agrees democracy is the only game in town. The problem is that the voters don't agree it's a game worth playing. And I mean, you know, the voter apathy doesn't just exist here in the U.S.
No, no, absolutely.
In Japan,
well, apathy, and there's some, right, in Japan. I mean, of course, every country has its different, and regions have different dynamics. There are certainly parties that are non-establishment. So in many parts of the world, these have been the left-wing parties that have passed, and many times unsuccessfully. We talked a lot about Greece on this show, and they basically got beaten by the European financial and monetary authorities.
Yep.
I'm not even going with the thing that, like, oh, it's the Germans that got them, because I'm joining the same kind of stupid nationalistic game that hides what's really going on, which are oligarchs, right? Very powerful, economically powerful people, that control really the economies and therefore the states. Most recently and rather shockingly, Portugal voted in another left-wing party.
I saw that, and there's something going on where they're, like, not going to be allowed to take office.
Oh, yeah,
let
me tell you. So first of all, just the quick back, just one more bit of background is that when I'm talking about left-wing parties, I know in America everybody's told that left-wing is, well, it's socialism, right? That means big government, and right-wing, that's, what is that? Well, free markets, that means small government. That is a mistake. That's not the case.
But the Nazis, arguably about as right-wing as you can get, technically, you know, their name, National Socialist Party.
Right. Yeah, right. And they were not neither in many ways.
They had their own thing going.
And the Soviets actually never really, barely began chapter one. I mean, getting rid of the Tsar was definitely a good thing. I think very few people outside of his immediate family would argue with that. What after? I mean, in a Chinese context, one could maybe some people, obviously in Taiwan, I think that, yeah, we should have stayed with getting rid of our czar, our emperor, and staying with a national non-communist party. Maybe all of these things are wonderful, and worth our arguing. But it's not, we have free market giant or centralized authorities, and we have countries that call and they call themselves free market with a very unfree market, like America today, or most countries that are capitalist. They are, all of them are hybrid in different ways. So this dichotomy is highly misleading. As a teacher of economics, it's always like something that needs to be taken care of quickly, but so that we can get to the real business.
Right.
It's not right. Socialism, really, if you want to go old school, pure, it's about workers owning and managing their operation. That's the core thing. That's what socialism is. Now the Soviets, right after the revolution, kind of betrayed their own ideals immediately and completely by creating what could best be defined as state capitalism. So capitalism in the sense that the workers just earn their work and take orders as usual. But the state, the government is in charge. It owns not only the operations, right? All the enterprises, the factories, everything.
Far
shops,
less,
everything.
Far less dynamic.
That's not socialism at all. That is simply state capitalism, in many ways similar to what, by the way, the Nazis had going.
Right.
And there you have it. So it's a little bit more complicated. But in Europe, the new left parties, of course, understand that the Socialist Party in Europe, most main European countries, is just like the Democrats. So, in some sense, you know, diet conservatives, right? Not really.
Conservative light.
The French Socialist Party, the official one, is imposing, is much like the Democrats in America, you know, basically imposing what Ronald Reagan back in his day wouldn't dare do, and not because he was a coward, because he wasn't that much of a fool. Cutting budgets, austerity, we call it around the world. In America, austerity is not really a word that is very popular. We're talking about this obsession of cutting budgets when it's not really that necessary. And of course, choosing to cut budgets that are service to the proverbial 99 or maybe the proverbial bottom 50%.
But he actually did that.
That are, it's also petty change. I mean, you know, just all of those subsidies that we kind of started the show with, where local governments or federal governments or at all levels are handing, our property that was purchased by our, taxpayers' money and handing it over to private interests. That's one way in which they do it. Transfer of funding to private enterprise that doesn't really need that much assistance, quite frankly, like oil companies and tech military companies. They're doing fine. I'm not even challenging the whole how productive they are for America's long-term health here, but they don't need the assistance. But then orders of magnitude, several zeros more than all the assistance to the poor to all put together. So if we do want to cut the budget, which we really shouldn't be too worried about, quite frankly, and we can discuss that a little bit, it's really one of the big, it's not even a, maybe it's a racket, but it's at least a misunderstanding about how the macroeconomy works. But all over the world, people are electing parties who are new left, who disassociate themselves from that establishment left. And their prime platform is no more, or at least less austerity. You know, stop taking, bailing out the ultra wealthy and squeezing the poor in the middle class, as they have been doing worse than America ever has in Europe, by the way, for a long time now. I keep saying that people have this image of Europe as kind of Scandinavia in the 70s. Those days are long gone, long gone. Of course, the other option then, other than the mainstream, and you know that they are just corrupt and kind of ineffective, are the extreme right, which are kind of pretty scary people, generally, because they have all that kind of, you know, racism and as part of their package. It's happening too in America, right? What I just described should be reasonably familiar to Americans, right? I mean, how different they are, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, but they're feeding on the legitimate anger. Mm-hmm. Of a large chunk of the population, yeah.
I do have to make a comment though. You just said something that you know, a lot of people believe, but you know, you can take it or leave it. Ronald Reagan did do a lot of austerity as governor of California. He literally threw out
as president in 81.
He ran because he ran significant deficits.
He created a recession that was maybe necessary for the stagflation.
Yeah. We can't say he didn't do any austerity, because he did do austerity as governor of California. I mean, literally, messed over, the city of San Francisco by actually tossing, people who were mentally, sick out into the streets. And as a president, he did that too, except that most of the blame for all those mess ups that he did during his austerity went to Congress, you know, and all these other people. They were the ones that took most of the blunt. Ronald Reagan is just a fictional character people are trying to idolize, like he's Jesus. And he is not Jesus.
Talking about different things. I mean, you're talking about social actions, whereas what I'm talking about is just like, all right, let's look at a balance sheet.
Yeah, he runs
it. Let's look at the flow of funds.
It's the same thing. Whether it's social action or not, I mean, if you're cutting social services, you're actually cutting your budget, right?
No, you're not.
It's worthless.
Yeah, no, you can cut social services and run a much larger deficit. That's what the military's for.
Right.
I mean,
right.
There was a saying. Reagan had a quote. He said, "I thought B-52s are vitamins. Otherwise, I wouldn't have ordered so many of them."
Well, that's because that's because this chimp monkey from the movies was the one running the country at the time. Okay.
Well, no, no.
When it comes down to priorities, if you want to prioritize the big guys as, you know, the ones that are bringing in the money and the ones that need the insurance and all that, okay, fine. But the truth of the matter is, as an American, okay, this is our country, not, you know, a corporate or the army and all that kind of stuff.
That's an ideal. It's a noble ideal. Sometimes we moved a little bit into that direction, but we never even got close to the ballpark. Right?
But the consequences are today's crime and all this kind of stuff. So
lowest ever in American history right now in America.
Yeah,
the lowest
true.
Ever.
I just saw
since the 70s. Yep. It's been going down. Certainly violent crime. Of course, I'm not that.
Well,
one of the reasons
that can be
why
manipulated.
Why are we putting people in jail? Crime.
You can't. You can manipulate the stats, but if you look at the magnitude of the movement, I mean, you can bake it as much as you want.
And that's the worst of the crime of mass incarceration, is that just as we don't have a problem, but we're arresting people for no good reason in order to exploit them as slaves in the largest prison incarcerated population in the history of the world.
The crime wave has not gone down. I mean, it's the same comparison with employment. They just came out. The Obama administration came out and said that, the unemployment went down to 5%. I'm sorry, but where are those jobs?
Okay. No. But that's something else. There is no recovery. The economy is dead. It has been dead for years. The only reason it hasn't been stinking up the place was that the Fed was feeding it unlimited
life preserve.
Right.
I mean,
just
that's
like
the thing.
A very injured person on the table, right? Where if you cut the machines, they're dying. And it's not going to get, not getting any better.
Interestingly,
precisely.
By the way, the Fed's cutting, it's going to start cutting the machines probably this December.
Yeah,
it'll
I know.
Be interesting to see how that pans out.
Already stopping the quantitative easing has significantly slowed down the pretend recovery.
They call it quantitative tightening.
So what are we doing here? So I'm just saying, I'm being cynical here that the only way you can get the system to work a little bit better, and an absolute precondition for some kind of far from perfect but relatively better kind of liberal in the old sense of the word, right? Free market, don't tell me how to live my life. Capitalist system cannot allow ancien regime's levels of difference in power. The French had to, at some point, just storm, and stop the insanity. It wouldn't have happened probably without it. Britain managed with a little bit more, but less violence. No, to a point, it got spread out a little bit more primarily. But again, if you have people who are above the law, as we do, or people or institutions, all the powerful are above the law for all practical purposes. Not violating federal law and too big to jail, hiding the vast, by some estimates in the rich world, half of the wealth is hidden from even like accounting to be taxed, potentially. That's the thing. If you're powerful enough, you get away from it. And the job of the government, and this is not according to Marx, this is according to Adam Smith, is precisely, the father of this kind of free market thinking, is precisely to police, to be the referee. Right? To impose the rules of the game. Otherwise, we lose control of the game, don't we? But, this anti-austerity measures are precisely in line with what you were saying, Jesse. This notion of stop cutting our livelihood as we are on our knees due to mistakes you made.
Right?
This is extremely unfair. Now, people are angry. People are voting for, Republicans are voting for Trump because they don't want any of the other, because they know the others are establishment guys.
Yeah.
So I feel them. I feel them. I mean, the guy has some major issues that I would have major, I don't like him.
Yeah, like filing for bankruptcy 4 times.
Yeah.
So, you know what? I gotta say this.
Come on.
I gotta say this.
He feels bankrupt.
I loved how he handled
the precedent like that.
You know what? The way he handled that question, was priceless. Basically, what he said is, "Mr. Trump, you filed for bankruptcy." He's like, "I said it. I took advantage of the bankruptcy code." And he turned and he said, "Look, this country owes a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I know how to handle bankruptcy. Seems like you should have left me."
Yeah, so
he was such a raging racist. But maybe he's not even a racist. You know what? This is a card that somebody is. It's a niche. It is like an evolutionary niche in politics. Somebody on the right has to take that card.
He knows.
You know?
I mean, that's the thing, is he's playing the game.
Yeah, he is playing the game.
He knows how to market. Right? He knows how to market
card,
himself. But I mean, he knows it's a game. I mean, and that's look. I don't want to, pray at the altar of big business or anything, but I mean, the truth is that this is a guy who understands that it is a game.
He knows
right?
how to be a thief.
Better than those who are, better. I prefer it. Because again, I got nothing personal, certainly against this president or, you remember our principle of equal opportunity hate.
Right.
Right? But the establishment is the same, and it is criminal. And we can come up with little details. I mean, nothing makes me laugh bitterly but kind of cry a little bit, die on the inside. And then to hear liberals defending President Obama for being, he cut more deficit than he was even a worse class warrior, nasty, pro-big business, piece of bleep. Don't worry. No need to stretch over to the button. right? So, yeah. Yeah, he was actually good. I mean, that's one of the main pieces of rhetoric going on the Obama administration right now. How dare you say that? It's embarrassing for liberals to say that, because anybody who is semi-competent liberal knows that, no, you're supposed to actually, he was supposed to invest even more, not cut the budgets.
I know where you're going with Trump and the whole bet. You're basically saying, well, okay, if he gets in, then people will actually decide to rise up. Well, the truth of the matter is that is not going to happen. In today's day, with drones and everything else, and the police force being militarized the way it is, that is not going to happen.
Well,
so why would anybody in their right mind vote for a scam artist like Trump, who's filed bankruptcy four times? Is he going to go and say, China, we're not going to pay you. We're filing bankruptcy.
That's what he's running with. That's what he's running with.
It's not a bad idea.
It's not a bad idea.
So the Chinese will say, okay, let's say we have some wacko. And for a premier in China, go like,
but
what?
Don't.
You're ripping us off.
They have a very reasonable person.
You're ripping us off. Okay, we'll go to war. I mean, that's a good reason to go to war.
That's the thing. That's the thing is that they. That's the beauty of nuclear weapons. The most wonderful thing about nuclear weapons is that nobody's going to push the button.
True,
but nobody's going to push the button.
But then again, we don't need nuclear weapons to cause a lot of mayhem.
Let me say that. No major country. Right. You know, you might have like a rogue state push the button and destroy like one or two cities, but you're not going to have someone in China or someone in Russia or someone in the United States push the button and end the world.
No,
it's not going to happen.
They're not. But put it this way, the relations
The thing is, we
would actually invest so much more money that in the military
We already spend a ton of money on the military. We already have overmatch capabilities around the world. We don't need to spend any more. So maybe they start spending. But the truth is that because you've got nuclear powers, they would never even invest in a skirmish.
Yeah, it's not that model. It's not the Armageddon model of the good old days of our youth. But again, I mean, it breaks my heart to say that, but you know, we thought that George W. Bush was the war president, right? And,
Cheney?
But this is an important point in the sense that who's really in power and how does really power flow? And we have this kind of, we're brainwashed to this rabid individualism, I like to call it, not radical even, but rabid. So we put all our fears and hatreds into a kind of a person,
right?
And or all our hopes and love into a
fascinating statistic is to see something as in the media coverage, what percentage of say airtime is devoted to the presidential election versus Senate, right?
Mm.
The House.
True.
Local elections.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, we're raised to believe that we're in a democracy, right? I remember being educated as to how the government works, like fourth, fifth grade, you know?
Right, right.
You learn about the basic structure of government. But then, it's amazing. It's like, okay, well, we've got the president, but you've got this balance of power. You've got these checks and balances. And then everybody's like, well, let's just focus on the president, you know, and we project everything onto the president. And it's really amazing.
Well, it's like,
which is why I keep saying he is not King Obama.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not King anything. I mean,
but this is an old school trick too. I mean, as famously, of course, we can think of Stalin and, you know, and Hitler or what have you. But I mean, it works. That's why it works well. And it distracts us again from the real issues of what leads the fact that the same revolving door is in place. So whatever president comes in, doesn't really matter what happens. He gives nice speeches at best or not as nice, what have you. But again, this president that was elected, right, on a certain rather progressive platform.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the American people wanted change, right? And we could break
the
down.
The bumper stickers are still out there.
Yeah, the bumper stickers. But honestly, they actually wanted some pretty specific and wise things, clearly expressed in opinion polls and such. But that doesn't translate into policy. So on foreign, it's particular, it's on every level, economically speaking, the president, current administration has enacted policies that would have been very difficult in the days of Reagan to enact because they would be considered to be on the crazy right-wing fringe of the Republican Party, and Reagan would say this is politically unwise. They will lose too much capital here. Right? It's a small minority of cuckoos, but now this is the Democratic Party itself is there in terms of its policy. So what choice do we have? You know, you want to talk about wars? My God, let's not even go there because Bush can take lessons in terms of not, you know, escalating and creating new ones, you know, that we don't even talk about all the wars that are going on right now.
No, right.
I love what was Obama's recent thing with like no boots on the ground and then like 2 days later, there's a statement. It's like, oh yeah, you know, we've got like a couple hundred military advisors, but there's no boots on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, well, aren't advisors like technically soldiers? And, you know, aren't you kind of telling us about what? Snipers taking people out? And it's like, yeah, there's no.
You know, I got to give that to the Republicans. They're very upfront when it comes down to going to wars and, you know.
Well, they're not worried
about their social profile at all.
You know, the Hawks.
There's no difference. You know what? It's true what the Democrats say about the Republicans, that Republicans tend to make every time they make bigger government. And more deficits.
Yep.
So they're better kind of Keynesian liberals than Democrats are. Democrats come in, they become like hard-nosed, right. You know, Hayekian kind of on crack, yeah? And when it comes to foreign policy, it's the inverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In many, well, I agree. At best, they're the same. And perhaps maybe on the edges to Democrats, they somehow have, you know, when Republicans go to war, you have a lot of liberals, you know, screaming and yelling. But when the Democrats go to the war, not so much screaming and yelling going on. And the military-industrial complex we've been warned about, it's well beyond the warnings of Eisenhower back in the
day. Oh, yeah, no, that's
we're dependent on it in a tremendous sense.
And it's here to stay, basically. I mean, there's nothing we can do about it.
That's probably the reason why Sanders or Trump have a chance. I mean,
I've got a theory. I think Sanders is going to run as an independent.
I hope he does.
Can he do that? Oh, yeah. Tell me that, because that's one of the nicest things about him before this, right? That he was always independent.
Sure.
He was not a Democrat guy. He just running under
Democrats. He made it very clear that the only reason he was running on a Democratic platform was for logistical reasons. He said it like upfront.
Right.
And I mean, it's not like he signed any contract with the Democratic Party. I mean, he can go ahead and kick out and, you know, just go to be an independent. And I think that's what he's going to do because at this point, Sanders has garnered the grassroots that he wants within the Democratic base.
Anybody still supporting Clinton is like probably going to continue to support Clinton.
Yeah, they're going to support Clinton because they want to support Clinton.
They're full out denial. Yeah.
And the the thing is that, you know, I think Sanders has accomplished everything that he thought he could accomplish by running under the Democratic platform. I think at this point, his brain trust, you know, the people that are helping him run the campaign, they probably realize that the idea of him actually getting the Democratic nomination, it doesn't matter how much support he actually has. It's just, it's rigged. Hillary's going to get it.
Mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know what? You know, that's probably a card that he'll play very strategically.
And this stuff has been rigged since the 18th century.
Right.
Just to be quite clear about it. He happens to have better elites, maybe.
The polls right now, the polls, as far as that, is what you're saying is that the way he fares out right now, with the people who are 50 and up, they're basically backing Hillary, and then the people 50 and down are backing him up. And the thing is, I mean, you know, if we look at history
I want to use that to segue into a Facebook post I had about a week ago. Why are older people backing Hillary?
I mean,
it's not like she's got like a, you know, if you kind of
let me explain. When you reach a certain age, the faculties,
exactly.
What was I talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So it's the economization. It's true.
So bad.
It's the economization of thought, right? So I put something up on Facebook, right? About a week ago where it was just this random thought I had, which was that we have an aging population, right? And that as you age, it's pretty well demonstrated at this point, you don't think as creatively, right?
Right.
You literally economize your thoughts, right? You consolidate the narratives that you use to describe the world around you.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that economization involves basically closing off other people's opinions.
Right.
So, I mean, as a side effect of having an aging population, I think you have this polarization in the political sphere because people only want to hear how they perceive the world.
Right.
And then the media, right? The media is profit driven, right? So the media acts as an echo chamber. I mean, if you actually look at it, what the media does is they are basically politicians themselves. They pander to their political base. I'm not sure if you guys saw the movie Anchorman 2.
Yes.
Right? On the plane, actually.
So there was it was satire, but it was a very good point. Ron Burgundy, Will Ferrell, right? He says, instead of telling people what they need to hear, why don't we tell them what they want to hear? Yeah.
Right.
And that's exactly what the media is. I mean, that's what they've transitioned into.
But you know, your point is, I think, very good, and you can even look at it broader. We are experiencing real changes, right? I mean, this is a period of, there are more fundamental changes that are difficult to wrap your mind around, even if
there's I'm not changes quite people don't see, but they're there.
Right, right. I mean, and big ones, really big, important ones, on so many different levels, which we could open up. I find is the reason why we should really abandon disciplines, and or at least some of us should really be allowed to go out and think crazy thoughts outside of our comfort zones, because that's where we might get some interesting answers. So, along the lines you were saying, how come there's this pretty significant dichotomy between the older Americans and younger Americans, and real basic worldviews? It's an epochal change. It's very difficult for anybody to wrap their minds around these kind of things are going to be in some fundamental way different than they have been in centuries, not decades. And they're already different. We're just having a hard time wrapping our minds around them. Culturally,
technologically,
psychologically, technologically, the way we run things. I mean, your favorite, you should definitely take, we got the top of the hour to do, so we'll do it and keep on. Maybe we kind of cut ourselves off and talk a little bit about the robots are coming. I mean, you're the guy who started yelling the robots are coming.
I mean, like the Paul Revere, the robots are coming.
Well, there, but I think it's people are beginning to, and you continue to do so, and good for you. People are wrapping their minds around that. So it's impossible to deliver a decent job for people willing to, you know, abide by the rules and live a decent life. No, you know, you have nothing to lose, nothing to gain. It's very dangerous. The very social contract of the nation states is falling apart. People have no trust in authority. And it's scary. So I'm just taking that generational thing you were saying and imagining the kind of generational split that every generation, since Sophocles at least wrote a book about it, Oedipus, right?
Yeah.
And probably before, he just wrote the book about it.
Those are the books we have. That's where the library ends.
Right. Before it was probably Burns. Tales Told, or just Tales Told.
Around the Alexandria.
But at any rate, when in periods of rapid technological change, rapid societal changes, these things are amplified tremendously. Now, how big? It's at least as big as early industrialization time we're living in right now. And sometimes I truly think that on some levels, it's like the early modernity. So we're facing that transition, that 17th century. And that's really scary. Really scary. A transition from feudalism to, wage labor and modern era. I think especially in cultural things, because, well, I don't know. In 100 years we'll be able to really look at this carefully, right? Just like the past episodes. But there are these parallels that keep showing, I think. And most of it is scary because of the period of transition and because of the environmental limits.
So anyway, let's go for the top of the hour
let's
stuff.
Do that thing, yes.
Yeah. Let's see.
Well, 10 minutes after I keep the law.
I always keep forgetting to bring the file with me, but the views and opinions stated here today are solely ours and not of those working here at WPRK, Rollins College, or whatever, you know. Right. Just know that it's ours, and usually we're right.
Music.